It's the Brian Mara Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And we have a little bit of breaking news. Yet again, it involves the NYPD and its response to the George Floyd protest of last summer. And yet again, the complaint is specifically about what they did in Motthaven. Just minutes ago, 24 aggrieved New Yorkers dropped a demand letter on the desk of Mayor Bill de Blasio with a copy to City Controller Scott Stringer. They are demanding immediate action after they say they were assaulted, kettled, pepper sprayed, zip tied, and in many cases arrested, all while attempting to exercise their right to First Amendment expression and assembly in a part of the city that they say has been subjected to generations of violence and discrimination at the hands of the police. Reporter Jake Offenhartz was there for WNYC and Gothamist and spoke with Kai Wright shortly after 9:30 that night during our special coverage of the protests.
Basically, as the clock struck 8 p.m., another group of cops came from behind with batons out and started pushing people. And it was a really scary and claustrophobic scene in there. And I don't know that it's been freed up yet. I think they might still be there. They're not letting us anywhere near it.
The next morning, the police commissioner defended the department on WCBS radio, saying outside agitators had promoted the use of violence and property damage.
They put out posters advertising that they were going to burn things down, that they were going to injure cops, that they were going to cause mayhem. That was the plan. We disrupted the plan.
But since then, Human Rights Watch and even the NYPD's own Department of Investigation, the city's Department of Investigation, have identified the NYPD's attacks on protesters that night in Motthaven as a particularly egregious example of the NYPD's bad response to the Black Lives Matter movement and protests of last summer. So we're going to try something new when it comes to police reporting here at WNYC, a reporting project that seeks to talk about reform of the system in a whole new way. We want to talk about how people are policed and why. Joining me now, Selena Martin. She is one of the 24 people who have signed the demand letter that landed on Mayor de Blasio's desk less than an hour ago. They are asking for, among other things, a reparation fund for the harm done in Motthaven on June 4th. Selena, thank you so much for giving us some time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having me on the show today.
And Selena, we're going to invite callers to join this conversation. So listeners, anyone who was in Motthaven that night, we invite you to call in. Some of you called us the next day and have called us since. So if you happen to be out there before, if you were in that particular demonstration, 646-435-7280, as various levels of government and citizen activists are revisiting this incident now because there has not been closure. What did you see? What was your experience? This segment is not just about the demand letter, but it's in the context of this new reporting project that we're launching today at the station, and we're inviting your help. So call us up, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, and tell us what you saw or experienced if you were in the Bronx during the protest on June 4th. Focusing primarily on Motthaven for now and the immediate surrounding area in that particular protest that night. And also joining us is Jamie Floyd, WNYC Senior Editor for Race and Justice, who's producing this project that we are calling 24 Minutes in Motthaven. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning, Brian.
And Jamie will tell us more about the reporting project in a minute. But first to you, Selena Martin. Tell us about your experience in Motthaven on June 4th. Like, when did you get there that night, and what did you see at first?
When I first got there, I got there about 6:15 in the evening, and the cops had already been there, and they were assembled where we were gathered. And just throughout the night, we were marching and going through the streets, and about 7:45, we had been trapped at the Mount Haven housing projects, And that's where the series of events occurred, with us being kettled and pepper sprayed and beat with batons.
Was it a peaceful protest to that point in your experience? You heard the clip of the police commissioner from the next morning where they were concerned because there were posters, he says, that were advertising that people were going to burn things down and that they were out to injure cops and cause mayhem, the term he used.
That night, we were gathered together. We were marching through significant areas in surrounding Mount Haven. And there was music and drums beating. It was very powerful to be in. There was no mayhem to me or chaos occurring. And it seemed fairly peaceful.
The police closed in because it had passed 8 o'clock. There was an 8 o'clock curfew in effect that night. And they just had determined that anybody who was out after curfew was going to get arrested if they wouldn't disperse.
From the moment that we began marching, the police had continued to follow us. Even before the 8 p.m. curfew had hit, they had already kettled us in and didn't allow us to leave from that group.
And before we bring in Jamie, I understand you were pepper sprayed and then arrested. Would you tell our listeners what that experience was like to you? You can give us a little bit of the moment by moment of that. I don't think people get to hear that very much from people who are on that end of it.
Yes. So that night I witnessed and experienced the excessive force and violence from the police. And I felt fear. I felt the fear within myself and that of others that had been put in the people. At one point, I couldn't breathe. I felt claustrophobic because of the kettling, the police from the front, the police from the back and in the front were pushing in on us and really squishing us to the point that I couldn't breathe. And multiple people were shouting and screaming that they couldn't breathe as well. I almost felt like we were in a box of sardines because of how squished we were, and toppling over each other because we were on a hill. So we were almost toppling over each other. And at one point, I was pinned to a car, and I couldn't move. And there was a few police officers that jumped on the car and started beating the people with batons, the protesters with batons. And I felt fear in that moment that I was going to be hit in the face with this baton. And it was very scary. And I thought that I was going to die at one point or extremely harmed. And I was scared and I was worried. And I had been pepper sprayed, as you mentioned, that I did get pepper sprayed as I made my way to the sidewalk. And there was so much adrenaline going on, so much screaming and people being hit and dragged on the floor, people being pepper sprayed and hit with batons. I just remember bones cracking from the force of the batons on people's bodies and screaming. And I think I was just in the rush of things and the adrenaline and just trying to get to a point where I felt safe that I didn't even realize that I had been pepper sprayed in that moment.
You know, go ahead. No, you want to finish the thought? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that the police officers kept going back and forth about allowing us to leave because within that sidewalk, we also had been kettled and we were attempting to get help for an older man who had been pepper sprayed in the eyes and he couldn't open his eyes at all. And the police didn't make any effort to assist or support him. And I had been pushed to a tree and I couldn't move. And then that's what led up to my arrest when we were pleading to be released. And at one point, the officer, a female officer, had asked if we wanted to leave, and we said we did. And another officer had came and said that if she was allowing us to leave, and then she agreed. And the moment that we stepped out, that's when he grabbed me by my arm and twisted it and had zip tied me and had arrested me.
Oh, zip tied. You know, I think a lot of Americans only became familiar with the term zip ties in the last few weeks since the January 6th insurrection. That was one of the things that indicated that they were really out for violence and potentially to kidnap members of Congress because they were carrying zip ties. People haven't heard that term. They know handcuffs. They don't necessarily know zip ties. So what was that experience like, being in zip ties?
The zip ties were extremely painful and tight. They had put them really, really tight where I could barely even move my hands. My arms were twisted in a position that was very uncomfortable. And my hands felt swollen. They were turning almost purple and numbed. And I had them on for several hours, for more than 5 hours. So I couldn't even feel my hands. And it was raining that night as well. So it was very cold and my hands were numb. It was just an awful, awful experience.
Also with us, I'm sorry, to the point, go ahead.
To the point where several days after I had the zip ties removed, that my wrists were sore and swollen and tender from the tightness of the zip ties.
Also with us now and being very patient, WNYC's Jamie Floyd, senior editor for Race and Justice here at WNYC and producer of this new reporting project called 24 Minutes in Mott Haven. So, Jamie, I think this is not the first time you've heard Selena's story, but, you know, people don't usually hear these stories laid out in such detail in relatively long form like this. So what are you thinking? What are you feeling? And introduce people to this reporting project, if you would.
Yes, not at all patiently, Brian. I was riveted and on the edge of my seat, even though, yes, I've heard Selena's story, and there are 23 others like it in this demand letter that went to Mayor de Blasio this morning and City Comptroller Scott Stringer, and we'll talk a bit more about what the demand letter is asking. But I think, Brian, it's important to emphasize that Selena is not a professional community organizer. She's not an activist. She's a social worker at a school in East Harlem. Mm. And she was in Mott Haven to exercise her First Amendment right to protest peaceably and to freely assemble. And you and I, Brian, have talked about the Constitution so many times on your show. You know I am a constitutional advocate, and I advocate for those who want to exercise that right, those rights. And the police, their job when we assemble is to protect and serve us, to help us help them. Their job is not to do what these 24 people say happened to them that night. They are not supposed to beat or pepper spray or exert excessive force. We do expect that if there's a violent crime occurring, but not during a peaceful protest. And yes, I did hear Dermot Shea say that they were reacting to threats from the crowd. But the evidence in the DOI report that you mentioned, Brian, and other investigations and reviews that have happened in the ensuing months is that the police came to Mott Haven, a predominantly black and brown community, that night with a plan. And this was their plan. So, Brian, that's what has to change. And that's what we're doing with this project, 24 Minutes in Mott Haven. It's a collaboration here at WNYC, a new kind of reporting project. And that's because the events in Mott Haven, Brian, were an extreme example of the ways in which our community and our policing relationship is broken. I would dare to say it's not even existent in some communities. And so the Race and Justice Unit, when we heard about this demand letter, it's not a lawsuit. So let's clarify that. We've done that before, right, Brian? It's not a special monitor. We have one of those after Stop and Frisk. And now Tish James is calling for another. Instead, this is a letter asking the mayor, asking the comptroller, asking city officials to come to the table and talk reform, talk reparations, join a conversation about about really making the change we want to see. Not just apologies. The mayor has apologized for Mott Haven, but action. And, you know, Brian, when we the Race and Justice Unit, heard about this demand letter, we thought it was an opportunity to launch this new reporting project today. So through the lens of what happened in Mott Haven on June 4th, we're hoping to launch a different conversation about policing and reform. Gothamist's Jake Offenhartz just dropped the demand letter reporting on Gothamist this hour, and he'll be part of our ongoing reporting project, which will roll out on Gothamist over the next several months. But we'll also be working, Brian, with Kai Wright and the U.S. of Anxiety team, the narrative unit. We're going to work throughout the station to talk about policing. I heard Andy Yang talk about changing the culture of policing. He's mm-hmm. right. And that's what this project is about. Much more to come, Brian.
And also with us for a couple of minutes now is Jen Rolnick-Borchetta. She's the managing director of impact litigation at Bronx Defenders and is coordinating with some of the defendants from Mott Haven. Jen, thank you for giving us a few minutes on such a busy day.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here to talk with all of you.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the demand letter. I understand there were 260 people arrested in Mott Haven on June 4th and thousands more in the streets who encountered police officers that night. So how did you find or select these 24 people to join this collective? And then maybe also lay out a little bit about what the demand letter specifically demands or asks for.
Well, we sort of found each other. The collective of 24 people we're representing who are making this demand in the Bronx Defenders. Soon after the June 4 protests, you know, not long into June 5, we at the Bronx Defenders began to understand just how awful the NYPD's violence was towards protesters the night before. You know, we saw videos of officers beating trapped people with batons. We heard from our staff who had been there offering legal support who were themselves beaten by the NYPD, and we wanted to offer services and support as quickly as we could. One of those services was from my team. My team is a civil rights practice within the Bronx Defenders, and we put out a public notice advising people that we could help if they wanted to bring claims against the NYPD. And people began emailing and calling us seeking that help. We responded as quickly as we could. We were offering a specific type of help, and that's what we explained to people when we spoke to them. We were not offering to bring a lawsuit, at least right away, and there were lawyers available to them who would be able to do that. What we were doing was something different. We were offering to bring people together as a collective to demand that the city and the comptroller settle their claims before trial, before they had to file a lawsuit, in order to reckon with and repair the harm without putting people through the delay and what is often trauma of litigation. And these 24 people were eager, I would say, to be a part of this group and to come together to collectively demand what might be more transformative change for the people and the community who were injured that night. We gave some priority to people who were in the Bronx, but otherwise it was first come, first serve. And when we hit 24, that was the number we thought that my team, given that we are small, could responsibly handle. And the demand, what it looks for, is reparations, for recognizing that what happened is wrong. And a major component of the demand is a reparations fund. It's compensating the people who were injured by this protest violence by the NYPD, and also giving back resources to the community, because the community was harmed too. This mass violence against Black and brown people, predominantly in a predominantly Black and brown neighborhood, caused its own kind of injury to the Mott Haven community, and that needs to be addressed too. And so this fund would give back to people who were injured and give back to the community as well.
Selena, as one of the, I guess plaintiffs is the wrong word because it's not a lawsuit, but as one of the signatories to the letter, what do you hope the city would do that would repair the damage to you in some way as an individual or to the group?
As was mentioned, we want funds and reparations for individuals and the community harm, and we want to prevent police violence and the harm caused by policing in general, because what occurred and continues to occur every single day is unacceptable.
And Jamie, for you as our legal editor, as well as race and justice editor, why the demand letter as opposed to a lawsuit? What leverage do they have with merely a letter, if that's the right way to characterize it, as opposed to going to court?
Well, as Jen suggested, and as you know, Brian, litigation is difficult, traumatic, expensive, and frankly hasn't worked, Brian. I mean, you and I have been down this, we've been to this movie before, as I've said to you on other stories. I mean, we've talked about the Human Rights Watch report, the DOI report, the lawsuit that Tish James has filed. And then this is just in the context of the George Floyd protests and demands for reform. We've talked about Eric Garner. We've talked about Black Lives Matter being founded before that with Trayvon Martin in 2013. And Brian, we could go back to the Mullen Commission in the 90s, the Knapp Commission in the 70s, and the conversation continues. The change doesn't happen. So this letter is an opportunity, an offer for Bill de Blasio, for Scott Stringer, who is running for mayor, I need not mention because you just discussed it a moment ago when you asked Andy Yang about progressivism in the mayor's race. It's an opportunity for them to come to the table and really talk about reparations, think about reform, and offer a measure of reckoning to a neighborhood that has been over-policed. I know this, Brian, because I'm a native New Yorker. Mott Haven and the Bronx have long experienced the consequences of over-reliance on criminalization and policing to address what are really socioeconomic problems. And that's what I believe Selena and the other 23 are asking the city to reckon with in this demand letter.
We invited callers, first from anybody who happened to be at the protest that night in Mott Haven, in addition to Selena. Nobody who happened to be in that relatively small group happens to be listening right now. But we have gotten people with some questions calling in. So let's take one or two at 646-435-7280. Bill in Yorkville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call and hello to your guests. I was not present at the Mott Haven protest. I did attend various Black Lives Matter protests over the course of last summer. And the particular reason for my call, I guess this is responding to the larger point about how the police interacts with the community, is that, and I'll start with something that I saw just today. I live in Yorkville. I'm only a few blocks away from Gracie Mansion. And there are police barricades that have been up periodically blocking blocks since last summer. They're up again today, and I was just on a walk in my neighborhood, and I asked them, hey, what's going on? I have to admit, I'm really frustrated when I see this, and I'm pretty angry, but I try to just respectfully say, hey, what's happening? And I was told that today, and I checked on Twitter, apparently there is a Taxi Workers Association protest today regarding the mounting debt crisis for the cab drivers in the city. And they told me, well, there's a protest. We have a division whose job it is to find out when and where protests are, and so we just sort of pop up. And we just can't have them driving down this block. It's something I've noticed over the past year, not just in my neighborhood, but throughout the city. I commute to Washington Heights for work every single day, often on my bike, and I ride through Harlem. There are entire stretches of St. Nicholas Avenue that were co-opted by police precincts, barricades up. They turned it into a parking lot, places outside the bridges and tunnels. And it's been persistent over the past year. And I think it sends a very... just a terrible message. The way I take it, I'm not a marginalized person. And listen, I know Yorkville is not a marginalized community, but the way I take it is that you look down upon us and you look down upon our community, our you know, as citizens of this city, our ability to protest and to have you hear us when we don't like something that's happening.
Bill, I'm going to leave it there and get one other caller in before we run out of time, and that's going to be Edwin in East Flatbush. You're on WNYC. Hi, Edwin. Thank you for calling.
How you doing? You know, it's an honor to be able to lend my voice to this program. I am an active NYPD lieutenant, but I'm speaking as a private citizen. And what I want to speak to, which encompasses the issues with protesting that people have been having with the police department and just the larger ecosystem, is reform in general. Reform has not been working because the people responsible for implementing the paradigm shift, you know, whatever came from the litigation and the legislation and the activism, are literally the same people who are responsible for the problem in the first place. So they don't, behind closed doors, they sabotage. Whatever's supposed to change is sabotaged. We need to find the justice-minded officers who exist throughout the department who are pigeonholed and stonewalled. We need to find them and get them into key positions, decision-making positions, in order, if we're ever going to get reform. Because I've watched as friends who are activists. I'm actually a whistleblower and current city council candidate. So I know a lot of activists since I've become a whistleblower 5 years ago. I've watched some activists who I consider friends go from reform to this close to saying, you know what, we might just need to abolish. And the reason is because every single situation, an incident where reform is called for, you know, step by step things are put out as to what can be done, they find that it doesn't work. It's not causing a change in behavior, you know, at a pace that's quick enough for the people.
So, Edwin, quickly, how do you change culture?
Again, we have justice-minded officers who are pigeonholed. And I'm not a fan of Commissioner Bratton, but I'll quote him. He said, you can seriously undermine any organization by putting the right people in the wrong positions. And the NYPD is guilty of that through and through. The people that belong in key positions almost never get there. Myself, I'm a lieutenant. I had to fight tooth and nail for each promotion because I spoke out as a police officer. And they tried to destroy my entire career. There are people I know as high in the ranks of inspector, even chiefs, who, again, cannot get into decision-making positions to really change this thing. They don't want to sabotage their careers, so they're not outspoken, but a lot of them come to me. You know, this is part of the reason why I decided to run for city council, because I want to help spearhead this thing once I'm in City Hall, hopefully the public safety chair. But that's how you change culture. You have to find the people who believe and are sincere about the change and put them in the key position.
Edwin, thank you very much. Interesting to hear from someone who describes himself, and I don't know Edwin, but he's describing himself as a active duty NYPD lieutenant and a whistleblower, as well as city council candidate. So to wrap this up, one question for you, General Nick Borchetta, and then Jamie, I'll just invite you to tell our listeners where they can hear more of this new reporting project that you're spearheading. Jen, to Edwin's point about how long this has been going on with particular reforms that don't seem to change the culture enough, you were one of the leading lawyers, our listeners may not know, on the stop and frisk litigation, which is getting to be a decade ago, in which a federal judge ultimately found that the NYPD's use of stop and frisk was racially discriminatory and unconstitutional. A federal monitor is in place to this day regarding that. And yet here we are almost 10 years later, still talking about policing and still talking about reform. So what are you thinking with all this experience and having listened to Edwin and what he thinks from inside it would take for real change? With all your experience in this area, what would it take? And forgive me, we're over time already, so if you can give me about 30 seconds on this.
What we hope to get from this action, which we're doing differently here, right? We're not doing the lawsuit here. We're doing a demand, like Jamie said, to bring the city to the table to reckon and repair now. And what we're hoping to get from this new approach is not just changes that look to the NYPD to fix the problem, because that's proven to be insufficient, but reparations that go to repairing and investing in the community that was harmed, because that just might make a real difference this time.
Jamie, Reporting Project, 24 minutes in Mott Haven. What can listeners expect?
Well, these are people, Brian. They're not just cases for a lawyer. They're not even just stories for us as journalists, right? These are people who have real lives, real families, real communities, and they have rights. So when we do this work, we are going to proceed in this project with that first and foremost. How are people policed and why? As you said at the top, Brian, how are people policed and why? So we begin today, 24 hours in Mott Haven. We'll be on Gotham as Jake Offenhartz broke this story about this letter that dropped on Mayor de Blasio's desk today. Maybe you can ask him about it on Friday, Brian. And so you can read Jake's reporting on Gothamist at Gothamist.com. And then we'll continue reporting it out on Gothamist. We will also be working with Kai Wright at US of Anxiety to bring you stories like Selena's in a more narrative form. And we're going to work in other places throughout our organization and hopefully cross-pollinate, Brian, a word we like to use at New York Public Radio, so that our listeners can participate as well.
And let me at least get the title right. I said 24 minutes in Mott Haven. Is it really 24 hours in Mott Haven?
No. It's 24 minutes, because within the span of 24 minutes, pardon my French, all hell broke loose.
Jamie Floyd, WNYC race and justice editor. Selena Martin, one of the signatories to this demand letter for reparations for what happened in those 24 minutes and beyond in Mott Haven on June 4th. And Jen Rolnick-Borchetta, an attorney for the group. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.